Put the things on top.
What do I do? Just leave it there? Hey? What's, I don't know what's up with this.
Two backups in case.
Yeah. I just wonder in case when I do need it.
Right.
Yeah, well, yeah. Nothing, right?
Yeah.
Crazy. I get it.
Have you recorded it since the day I saw you?
No, I didn't touch it. Okay, forget it.
Sorry.
You got a backup, right?
Yeah, we have two backups. Probably both of them. Is it recording?
This is standing on show. It's
recording right now?
No. Just put it on there. Oh, it's better than that. This
is recording now?
Yeah.
Where's the mic?
It's an internal mic. Record perfect.
Okay, so where's the mic from that? Hi.
Then just pause it.
Where's the mic?
Record internally there.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. This one records.
Good.
Okay, let's go. I don't know what to do with this thing.
I'll look at it.
Yeah.
If you bring it in, I'll try to play it.
Maybe we should just buy a simpler thing, you know. It's
one of these.
Over.
One second.
I'm sorry. Okay. Good evening. This series of lectures concerns itself with special great people that I had the privilege and honor of knowing personally. Therefore, it's not a question of who were the greatest people of the generation and who were the most important people of the generation. I am not one to pass judgment on that. The only criteria that I have is that these are people whom I knew, who I had a great deal of personal contact with, and in my opinion, they are all outstanding great people of a generation that is gone, that is no longer here. And I'm not going to give biographies. There have been biographies written about each and every one of these people. Sometimes the biographies don't even agree with each other. But rather, as it's mentioned in the title, these are personal reminiscences, personal impressions that I had and that I still have regarding these great persons, these great personalities that really had a profound influence on the Jewish world during their lives and even until today. So the first in the series, the one that I'm going to discuss tonight, is Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, I come to him from a number of directions, even though it was not until much later in life that I realized how interconnected somehow I was to him. I found out later in life that we were even slightly related. My uncle was a cousin to his first wife, which in Lithuania is pretty close relations. And it also always signified to me the matter of family, the importance of family. It was an Eastern European trait, family. And even if members of the family disagreed on, even on very important issues, they still remained family. And so I was delighted to discover when I was in Muncie already that somehow we had this relationship through my late uncle. And Rabbi Yaakov was a product of the great yeshiva in Slabodka. Now, in the Musar world, in the world of Lithuania in the late 1800s and early 1900s, Musar was dominant in the yeshivas. It controlled the yeshivas. And perhaps yeshiva was more prominent in terms of Musar than the great yeshivas Slabodka. Knesset Yisrael was named after Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement. The Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, rather, not the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, was Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, whose descendants are the heads of the Mir Yeshiva here in Jerusalem now. And Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel was called the Alter from Slabodka, the old man of Slabodka. He was called the old man of Slabodka when he was still in his 40s. Because the altar was a title more than a description. And the Rosh Yeshiva in Slabodka was Moshe Mordechai Epstein, other great lomdim, but the person whose stamp of guidance on the yeshiva was the altar of Slabodka. Later on, he moved in 1923, he moved the Slabodka yeshiva here to Eretz Yisrael. He moved it here to Yerushalayim and then later to Hebron. And after the pogrom, the Arab pogrom of 1929, when many yeshiva students were slaughtered, the yeshiva came back here to Jerusalem, but it changed its name. It no longer called itself Slabodka or Knesset Yisrael, but it called itself Yeshivat Hebron, and it's the famous Hebroner yeshiva here in Jerusalem. So Rav Yaakov is a product of that institution. But Rav Yaakov is too multifaceted a personality to be a product of anything. Rav Yaakov basically is his own man in a world where it's hard to find people who are their own people today. We are what others impose upon us, what others think of us. We are what we think that others would like us to be. But to be your own person, that requires a great deal of inner strength. And that was part of that generation, a completely different generation of people, different in kind, not just in degree. I mentioned today in the Talmud class that I teach at Or Sameach we have many, many great scholars today, many great Talmidei Chachomim. The Lord has blessed us with a rebirth of Torah that was unimaginable, but I do not find anyone that was the equal of the people that I saw when I was in the yeshiva 55 years ago. I just don't see those kind of people anymore. And it's simple, because it took 1,000 years of Eastern European Jewry to make such a person, and it was destroyed in 4 or 5 years. And you can't just start again and expect immediate results. And therefore, to a certain extent, this is a time capsule. To me, at least, it's memories sometimes on a lonely night when the nudniks have finally gotten to you. And all of a sudden, you realize what greatness there lay in the world. My first experience with Reb Yaakov was when I was a student in the yeshiva. My Rebbe was Rabbi Kreisworth, Zecher Tzadik Levrocha, Reb Chaim Kreisworth, who later became the chief rabbi in Antwerp. But when he was a young man, when he was 28 years old, he came to the Chicago yeshiva, the Beis Medrash LaTorah, to be its Rosh Yeshiva. Now it's something, he's 28 years old. When I knew him, he wore an electric blue suit with fancy ties. He had a little French beard. I mean, it was a different picture than the picture that's enshrined within us in later life. And how did he come to the yeshiva? He came to the yeshiva on the recommendation of Rabbi Herzog. Rabbi Herzog visited the yeshiva in 1947. Rabbi Korb, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, retired and moved to Eretz Yisrael. They were looking for a Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Herzog, who knew Rabbi Kreisworth, who spent the war years here in Yerushalayim, in fact, he spent the war years in Rabbi Herzog's apartment with his wife. So he said, I have the right man for you. And Rabbi Kreisworth was a nephew of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rabbi Kreisworth's father-in-law and Rabbi Yankiv's wife were brother and sister. So he asked, I remember Rabbi Kreisworth told us, he said, I asked the uncle. He always called him the uncle. We didn't know who the uncle was, because he never identified him by name, who was the uncle. So he used to tell us, I asked the uncle whether I should come to Chicago, you know, leave Yerushalayim to go to Chicago. And the uncle said, no, that'll be the wonderful thing you'll be able to build. You'll have students, the whole thing. So he said, so I came. One Friday morning, we're sitting in the shir, and a short little man comes walking in. So he looked rabbinic. So we all stood up for him. And Rabbi Kreisworth put a chair next to his place at the desk. And he turned around and a big beaming smile, he said, here's the uncle. And that's the first time I ever saw Rabbi Yankiv. Here was the uncle. And Rabbi Yankiv, who always had a half smile on his lips, spoke to us, and he spoke in praise of Rabbi Kreisworth, but he spoke in praise of the yeshiva. And I remember one thing that he said, you know, when you're 15, 16 years old, that you may remember it later, but it doesn't register on you at that moment. He said, there are older Rosh Yeshiva here in the yeshiva. The truth is, every other Rosh Yeshiva was older than he was. And he said, and they are all great scholars. They're all great Lomdim. And the truth was that they were all great Lomdim. And he said, the greatness of them is that they're able to accept a younger person that he should have this position and that there should be no disputes. And then he spoke to us about how the fact that disputes can destroy any yeshiva, can destroy any family, any home. And so we didn't know what in the world he was talking about. You know what his problem was. Later on in life, and certainly later on in my life when I headed a yeshiva of my own, I understood completely what he meant. And I had a greater appreciation not only for the greatness of Rabbi Kreisworth, but a greater appreciation for all of the other faculty as to how smoothly things went. And Rabbi Kreisworth really had an enormous influence upon tens and tens of young men then, who today, many of them are Rosh Yeshiva themselves, Rabbonim, scholars, authors of books, community leaders. From our little group of 35, 40 young men in those years, I once made a count that over 30 of them have achieved some sort of prominence in the Jewish world. And that was because of the fact that Rabbi Kreisworth was more inspiration than education. It was very hard to follow his shiur because he knew everything by heart and he couldn't understand how you didn't know it already. But in terms of inspiration, there was no one like him. And so we all felt fortunate that we got to meet the uncle. When I married my wife and I came into the home of Rabbi Levine in Detroit, so Rabbi Levine once told me a story. And I heard the same story from Rabbi Kamenetsky later. Exact same story. My father-in-law comes to the United States in 1938, right before the war. He comes to Erie, Pennsylvania to be the rabbi. He's the only Shomer Shabbos in Erie, Pennsylvania. And he's coming from being a Rav in Lithuania. He was a Rav there for 10 years. And here he comes to him. His sisters brought him over to Erie. He comes, in fact, he told us the story that Erie is near the lake and there's always a lot of snow in the winter. So he was trudging home one Friday night from the synagogue in the midst of a snowstorm, and a car pulled up alongside of him and rolled down the window, and it was the Reform rabbi, and he said, "Hop in, rabbi, I'll give you a ride home." Which he did not accept. So how did he get there? Why did he leave? So it would be nice to say that he had the prescience, he saw in advance what was going to be, but that would not be true. Because no one saw what was going to be. Even at the end, no one saw what was going to be. No one could have imagined it. Again, as I mentioned, that 1,000 years could be snuffed out in relatively speaking, a few months. And no one imagined that. But what happened was that he was a candidate for a very prestigious rabbinic position in Lithuania. There were two other candidates. One was Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. And then there was a third man, a leading student of the Ponovitch Yeshiva who was supported by the Ponovitch Rav. I later heard the story from the Ponovitch Rav also. So they chose between the three, and the board of directors, the leaders of the community chose my father-in-law. My father-in-law comes to shul, moves in, comes to shul the first Shabbos. He gets up to give his introductory speech. The moment he gets up, there's a riot in shul. They throw down the shtenders. They whistle. They throw towels. They won't let him say a word. Because unbeknownst to my father-in-law, there was a big dispute. The members of the synagogue, so to speak, resented the fact that the rabbi was picked by the board and not by the entire community. And because that happened, it didn't make any difference who would have got elected, they opposed it. Then they weren't going to let it. So that night, after this happened, Saturday night, my father-in-law, who was a very peaceful, serene, holy person, he decides he's not staying to fight this battle. So he packs up his bags. Now, he had had a position before. He had given that position to another rabbi. He didn't feel that it was correct for him now to tell the other rabbi, leave, because I'm taking my position back. So therefore, he's stuck, a wife and four children, without a morsel of bread, without any position. So his sister in Erie says, come to Erie. And that's how he came to America. And a year later, he brought over the family, he moved to Detroit, and he was a Rav in Detroit for over half a century. I hear that story. Once I'm sitting by Rav Yaakov, I used to go, that was my entertainment in Muncie, was to go by Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. I never wanted to disturb him, but every so often I had a chance to talk to him, and I asked him, Rebbe, is it all right if I come over? He said, yeah, can he gave me a time to come over. Wherever I would come over. So he was in a reminiscent mood. So he says, do you appreciate God's hand in a human life? So, you know, I'm the pious one. I said, sure, Rebbe. He said, no, you don't know, Nein, you're verstehten it. He told me, no, you don't really get it, right? He said, no American can understand it. Look, there ain't kein Amerikaner can es nicht verstehen. No one that's here. I said, Rebbe, why? I mean, in America, God isn't in America too? So he looks at me, you know, he had such a clever eye and such a great sense of humor. He says, he is in America, but do is there a Yankee? Here he's a Yankee, right? See, it's not the same. That's what he meant. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in Torah Vadas in New York, and they taught him what a Yankee was, so... So he said, I'll tell you a story. And he tells me the story. He's the candidate for this Rabbonus. He had no other position. And he said, and I didn't get elected. He said, I came home. His words were, this is Gewen Tisha B'Av in Shtub. He said, it was the Tisha B'Av. What are we going to eat? What are we going to do? How are we going to do? So he said, so I went to America. So he didn't go to America as a Rosh Yeshiva. He went to America first as a shamus in San Francisco. And then he was an assistant rabbi to an American rabbi who was a very fine, wonderful man. But he was the assistant rabbi to that American rabbi in Seattle, Washington. And from there he came to be the rabbi in Toronto, Canada. And from Toronto, Canada, he came to Yeshiva Masifta Torah Vadas in New York, until he retired and came to Muncie. So he said to me, he said, you know, he was Rabbi Yankiv and I was Rabbi Wein. You know how that goes. So he says to me, Rabbi Wein, he said, do you understand what would have happened if I would have gotten the position? My father-in-law came to visit us always the Yontiv time during the year. Whenever he would come, he would say, we have to go over by Rabbi Yankiv. So we used to go over to Rabbi Yankiv. I drove him there, and then I'm sitting there like a fly on the wall while they're talking. And they repeated the story to themselves, how they both were saved from that position. I heard that story 30 times from them. Every time they met, they said the same story to themselves. And Rabbi Yankiv used to say, you see how many grandchildren I have, how many great-grandchildren I have. And my father-in-law, who wasn't outdone in grandchildren or great-grandchildren either, would say, and it was palpable, the faith that there was a personal hand that guided them and preserved them. And because of that, they felt that great sense of responsibility to do something on behalf of the Jewish people. I heard the third version of that from the Panovich Rav, who's going to be one of the people that I'm going to speak about. The one who came to the position was his Talmud, because Rabbi Yankiv left and my father-in-law left, so his Talmud came, and Nevach, he was destroyed, consumed in the Holocaust with the whole town. And the Panovich Rav always told me that he regretted that he wrote the letter of recommendation. Because he said, without my letter, they never would have taken him either. And maybe he would have gone somewhere. But then he raised himself and he said, well, we can't think like that. If you think like that, he said, then we can't accomplish anything in the world. We can't think like that. We got to go on. So that was another connection that I had with Reb Yankiv. But the real connection that I had with him began when I was the Rav in Miami Beach. I was the Rav in Miami Beach in a shul in Beth Israel from 1964 till the end of 1972. And it was a different Miami Beach then. It was a different barrel wine then too. And they were wonderful years. I cannot describe to you how wonderful it was. I mean, we never locked the front door of our house. And we never locked an automobile. You know, so it sounds like a fairy tale, but that was what it was. And Miami Beach then was small as far as Orthodox Jewry was concerned. And the shul was originally not a very substantial shul, but then it grew into a very large shul, and it built a beautiful building that's still there, and it's a main congregation. The advantage of being a rabbi in Miami Beach was that the whole Jewish world came down in December, January, February, and you saw them. If I would have been the rabbi in Indianapolis or Minneapolis or even Chicago, I would never have gotten to meet these people, because why would they come to see me? But like this, I'm in Miami Beach, I'm so-called the rabbi in that area, right? So then rabbinic courtesy dictates, right, that you visit the rabbi, you talk to the rabbi. And I was then much younger than I am now. And these great people really helped me. They helped me in hundreds of ways, many of which, again, I did not realize till much later in life. We had a neighbor of ours, a single man, that owned a home. And he was a disciple of Reb Yaakov. And Reb Yaakov and his wife used to come down to Miami and spend the winter, and we already had retired from Tor Vadas, and he would stay in the home and was very close to us. And so that's how I really got to know him. I got to have a personal relationship with him. And when Reb Yaakov came to town, so there were people in Miami Beach who, for some reason or other, did not trust the local rabbinate. I'm sure that's that plague is not limited to Miami Beach. And therefore, they would save up all of their problems and all of their questions and all of their halachic doubts until Reb Yaakov came to town. And then they would descend on him en masse. So I remember I was once in Reb Yaakov's house, and he said to me, you know, the whole morning, he said, "Memacht me mishuge." They're making me nuts. He said, every problem, the school and the kashrus and the everything, you know, and the mikveh. So he looks at me, he says, "You know what I told them? I told them every question in Miami Beach, the Rabbonim in Miami Beach know the answer. How should I know the answer? I'm from New York." And he said, "I refuse to answer them." And it took years for the people to understand that he was not going to answer them. But the truth is that he never answered them. He said, "You got Rabbonim in town. What do you want from me? They know Miami Beach. I don't know anything," he said. He used to say, "Ich kum da obzuruin abissel." He said, "I'm coming to rest them. I'm on vacation. What do you want from me?" There were other people that came down to Miami Beach that did not adopt that attitude, who would answer almost off the cuff. And then, you know, then everything hit the fan. You know, then, the rabbi said this, and this one said that, and I need not tell you, Reb Yaakov always avoided that. And Reb Yaakov was a person of such sterling character, of midos tovos, good traits, and simple things that you could learn from him. I remember once, when I was in Muncie already, many times, my wife and I drove Reb Yaakov and his wife into New York that we had a common simcha to go to a wedding, etc. So I would drive them. Now, driving to New York is one of the more minor pleasures in life. And sometimes, you know, we had to get there on time. I remember once Rabbi Yaakov was supposed to be Masada Gedushin. He was supposed to take care of the wedding, and I was supposed to receive a bracha, and it was a very important wedding, and we set out in plenty of time. You get near the George Washington Bridge, nothing moves. 20 minutes, 30 minutes, I'm going out of my mind. Finally, we pull up to the toll gate, and I gave the person at the toll gate a $10 bill, so then the person had to give me change. He gives me change, I take, grab the change, roll up the window, and boom, and I'm going, right? And Yankov leans over to me, and he taps me on the shoulder, and he says, Rabbi Vine, you forgot to say thank you. You didn't say thank you to the man. He gave you change. Every time I see the George Washington Bridge, I hear Rabbi Yankov in my ear. You didn't say thank you. When Rabbi Yankov passed away, so there were all sorts of hespedim for him, and you really couldn't capture the person. In Muncie, you know, God has an ironic sense of humor, if I may say so. In Muncie, on the same block with Rabbi Yankov's house, is a large convent, the Roman Catholic convent. Now, the Roman Catholic convent was there before Muncie became Muncie. And then, and Rabbi Yankov lived what we call down the hill, which was a yeshivish, chassidish enclave. And we aristocrats, we lived up the hill, which was a little more modern. Then there was over the hill, but we'll talk about that another time. So, Rabbi Yankov is living next to this convent. We never gave it a second thought. After Rabbi Yankov passes away, the sister in charge of the convent comes and tells the group that Rabbi Yankov had in studying with him. She said, that little old gentleman, he would never fail to say good morning to us when he would walk past the convent. Now in Muncie, most of the time one Jew does not say good morning to another Jew. Sometimes you walk by somebody and you say to him, Shabbat Shalom, and he looks at you like, well, you're from Mars or something. I mean, do I know you? What have I got to do with you? And here, the Roman Catholic nun said, you know, I miss him. Because that was Midas Tovos, right? That was Slabotka, that was Musser. That's, you know, that's understanding that a human being is a human being. And Rabbi Yankov, we went to a wedding once, to another wedding. I mean, I have lots of wedding stories, but I'm not here to tell stories as much as we went to a wedding. to a wedding of a very, very fine Jew who was a Holocaust survivor. His entire family had been wiped out. He married again, and he had two children, and one was a daughter, and the daughter, for a number of years, was not married, even though she was then already in marriageable age. And then finally she became engaged, and we received an invitation for the wedding, and Rabbi Yankov went with us, Rabbi Yankov and his Rebbetzin, and we went together. We came to this wedding. I mean, you never saw a wedding like this in your life. There were live doves in a cage as the centerpiece in every table. I think it impaired your appetite a little, but Every imaginable thing was at that wedding. And it was then at a very fancy place that not many Orthodox Jews went to yet. Today it's already passé, but then it was, you know. So as we were walking out of the hall to get our coats, and Rabbi Yankov was the ultimate gentleman. The ultimate gentleman. So he's going to get the coat for his wife, so I also have to follow him. A man stops us and he says, "Did you ever see anything," he said, "so ostentatious, so out of character, so I can't take it. How could he have done that?" So Rav Yankiv, who always saw only the good, said to him in Yiddish, he said, "Vos verstehst du nit? What don't you understand here? Tonight they're genommen the Kome of Hitler. Tonight he took revenge on Hitler. It isn't the wedding of his daughter. He got even with them." As I heard that, you know, that was such a different spin on things. And he saw it that way. And therefore, he didn't think that anything was out of place. He didn't think anything was wrong. He didn't think anything was overdone. Because really, a man that lost everything, that now had another family, that was able to marry off the family, who came into financial wealth. So he took revenge on Hitler. So he said it was a wonderful wedding. Wonderful wedding. Rabbi Yankov was Chakima de Yehudoi. He was a tremendously smart, clever man. Clever is not the word for it. He just, at any time you wanted a good piece of advice, you would ask him. And he'd give you that smile of his. And he would never tell you directly. He would say, "If it were me, this is what I would do." He would never say, "Do this." He would say, "Voltes given, it would be my me. Perhaps this is what I would do." And you have to be smart enough to understand what he was telling you. Now, not many people were that smart. We had an occasion, a story that I always tell. I was by Purim. I used to bring shalachmonas, and then we'd sit down. So he was a big drinker. We would drink grape juice. That was the Purim. You know, that was what was on the table. The Megel Achayim made it on grape juice. And we sit down and, you know, and we were always in the good mood, Purim and everything. All of a sudden, a man walks in. And I would go very early in the morning before the crowd came. A man comes in and he says, "Rebbe, can I talk to you?" So I got up to leave. So Rabbi Yankov says, no, wait, I still want to talk. So I says, I'm sitting there again. I'm like an observer. And the man says to him, "Rebbe, my doctor says I have to go for a surgical procedure." So Rabbi Yankov says, "Well, you should have a refuah shleima, right? God should help you." He says, no. He says, "I'm coming to ask you." He said, "I have a choice of surgeons. One surgeon is Jewish and one surgeon is not Jewish. Who shall I go to?" So Rabbi Yankov looks at him and he says, "You go to the best surgeon. Go to the best surgeon there is." He doesn't accept that as an answer because he's coming for, an epiphany. He's coming, you know, for an answer from heaven. So he says to him, "Rebbe, what if they're both the same?" So Rabbi Yankov says, "There's no such thing. There's no such thing as both the same." But the man persisted, right? He didn't get it. So he persisted, and he said to him, he said, "But tell me, let's lu yitzuyor, let us imagine that they're both the same. Who should I go to?" So Jacob says, "Well, if everything if everything is the same, then, you know, then go to the Jewish doctor." He said, "You see that all the non-Jews go to the Jewish doctor." So the man says, persists. He says, what if I have a choice between two Jewish doctors? One is observant, Shomer Mitzvahs, and one is not observant. Who should I go to? So Rabbi Yankiv says again to him, you should go to the best doctor. And he persists again, what if they're both the same? And Rabbi Yankiv says, it can't be that they're both the same. And he says, well, who Yitzuya, that they were both the same, who should I go to? So Rabbi Yankiv says, well, if you feel that everything is equal, so, you know, then go to the observant, go to the Shomer Shabbos doctor. So the man says to Rabbi Yankiv, how can I go to the observant doctor? He didn't listen to the Rashi Yeshiva, he went to medical school. Rabbi Yankiv looks him in the eye and he says to him, he said it in Yiddish, I'll translate it in English, he says, Anes vaze folgen uns nit. He said, it's a miracle that they don't listen to us. That God gives them the brains not to listen to us. Such a clever answer. And in the Rabbonis many times, he was the one that really gave good advice. And most of the advice was, Rabbi Wein, don't do anything. And I rarely regretted what I did not do. Just as I rarely regretted what I have never said. And he was a very, very astute person. When I, in Muncie, I helped found and build a shul called Beis Torah. I was the Rav there for 25 years. It was way up the hill. And it served a modern Orthodox crowd. The best of all worlds, the Haredi rabbi, a modern Orthodox Balabatim. The opposite is disastrous. When we had the groundbreaking, I invited all the Rabbonim to come to the groundbreaking. The only one in town who came was Rabbi Yaakov. And he spoke, and he took a picture with the shovel. And he said, yeah, it's a wonderful thing. We're building a new shul in our community. He didn't say, you know, they're modern, you know, they got that. And 5 years later, after my years at the at the OU, as when I opened my yeshiva in Muncie, Shari Torah, so he came again. The problem with the yeshiva in Muncie was that it was too successful. And there were people who felt that, they owned yeshivas and they owned who should be a Rosh Yeshiva and that interlopers should be excluded. So there was a rabbi in Muncie who sent out 4,000 letters in which he said the yeshiva should be closed and that mine has no right to be a Rosh Yeshiva. And the letter, 4,000 letters, everybody in Muncie had something to talk about. I didn't call Rabbi Yankiv on this. I ignored the matter, even though it's not always easy to ignore things, but I ignored it completely. I didn't respond. I didn't speak about it. However, someone went to Rabbi Yankiv and spoke to him about it, and Rabbi Yankiv sent out 4,000 letters in which he said, not only you should disregard the previous letter, but that it had no right to be written, and that it's a calumny, and the yeshiva, one should not So that neutralized the matter. So the man who sent out the first 4,000 letters called him up and said to him, I want to meet with you and talk to you. He said, now you want to meet with me? Before you sent the letter, you didn't want to meet with me. Now you want to meet with me? He said, now I have nothing to talk to you about. And I find it interesting that 8-9 years later, I used to meet this other rabbi very often. God has his ways. We would always meet in the bank, which is the second home of all Rashi Yeshiva, pleading that they don't bounce the check, just wait till tomorrow, you know, I'm going to cover it. I would always meet him in line at the bank. And I would say to him, good morning, how are you? And after 6, 7, 8 years, you know, he apologized to me. So I told him, I certainly accept his apology and I have no hard feelings anymore. But I said, you know, next time you think about doing something, you should first consult with Rabbi Yaakov. I said, I didn't open the yeshiva without consulting with Rabbi Yaakov. I went to him. I asked him whether I should do it, whether there's such a place for such a yeshiva. And I asked him, what are the principles by which such a yeshiva should be run? And I said, you know what he told me? He told me two things. He told me, you should know the first thing is make the yeshiva for the students, not for the faculty. He said the problem in hospitals is that hospitals are made for the doctors and the nurses and not for the patients. Those were his exact words. He said a yeshiva should be made for the bocherim and not for the rabbeim, which is a very simple idea, which is enormously difficult to communicate and to execute in practice. I used to tell my rabbeim in the yeshiva, you know, guys, it's better to learn 2 hours than not to learn 4 hours. Because they would make a schedule, you know, like they were in Volozhin. You know, so then the first Seder was 4 hours. I said, these guys can't sit for 4 hours. He said, even the football game doesn't take 4 hours. So let's make it 2 hours and they'll come and they'll learn and everything. It's better to learn 2 hours than not to learn 4 hours. But they were afraid of the public image. They'll say, oh, in that yeshiva, they only have 2 hours Dorim. They don't have 4 hours Dorim. Because it's always the outside, not the reality that governs us. So that was the first thing he told me. And the second thing he told me is, don't make the yeshiva a zdom bed. In zdom, there was a bed that if a person was too long, they chopped them down to fit the bed. And a person was too short, they stretched them out to fit the bed. In other words, everybody was the same. Zdom was conformity. Everyone had to be the same. He said a yeshiva shouldn't be a zdom bed. Everyone is different. Not everyone the same. You have to treat everyone differently. And that was really a lesson that he undoubtedly learned from the altar in Slabodka, because the altar was the master at doing that. Who to be nice to, who to be rough to, who to make a rabbi out of, who to tell him to go into business. So that was a greatness. And then finally he told me, he said a general rule. He said, in our time, a yeshiva is to include people and not to throw people out. So he said, you have to be very careful. He said, there are undoubtedly students that will have to be sent away. But he said, how you send them away will make all the difference in the person's lifetime. And really, he quoted to me the Gemara, L'olam yehi odom, you mean Makarev Smol Doche. You have to hold on with your right hand while you push him away with your left hand. But your right hand has to always hold him. So you have to find a place for the student to go to. You can't just leave him on the street. You have to do it in a way that doesn't destroy, not only destroy him, but destroy his attachment to Torah and to Judaism and to his family and to everything else. And that is really an important thing. And because of that, his advice, you could consult with him. He was so clever in understanding human beings. And he never said, you know, America. He never said that. You know, people said, well, what can you do? They're Americans. He never said that. But he said that you have to adjust to the American psyche and to American life and to what kind of people they are. He hated machlokas. I remember I once asked him, our children were a marriageable age, once asked him, you know, how do you deal with mechutonim? How do you deal with the other family who always are not worthy of you, but somehow that's the way it is, right? What do you do? So Rav Yankiv said to me, you never argue. Whatever the mechutonim want, that's it. So he said, I'll tell you about my own case. He said, some of my children, my wife and I, walked the chos and the kala down the aisle together, and some of the times we did it separate. Whatever the mechutonim wanted, that's what we did. That's the rule. So he said, the rule is not separate or together. The rule is the mechutonim. He always used to say that a person should be careful from the kleinigkeiten, from the small things in life, the petty things that undo us. So he used to say, Dover Godel, the great thing is Masse Merkova, the Gemara says. Masse Bereishis. To understand God, so to speak. Oh, that's a great thing. He said, everything else is a small thing. And therefore, not to let the small things get to you. And I saw it many times with him, and that was his advice to others. So for instance, many times in Miami Beach, people did not give him the proper respect. Either they didn't know who he was, or they didn't care. And he was completely impervious to it. Made no impression upon him. And that made him greater, not smaller. Eventually, he set a shear in Miami Beach in the Sovereign Hotel for years. And he had this Gemara shear, and it was one of the great attractions of the hotel. I mean, he turned the hotel into a tourist attraction. That the religious Jews that wanted to hear a shear, Rabbi Yankiv said every day. And he enjoyed it so. It rejuvenated him. So he told me once after the shear, I was there once for the shear, after it was over, and the shear took a lot out of him. He was not that young anymore, and when he said with all of his energy, and there were a lot of people there, so he had to say with a louder voice. And people came up to him, and they said, you know, Rebbe, maybe you'll take it easy. Maybe you won't say it tomorrow. We'll see if we can make it more comfortable for you. So he said to me, they think I came here on vacation to rest. I came here because I wanted to say the shir. That's why I came here. And this is a place where I can say the shir. And that was his attitude, how things went. I used to discuss with him problems many times in shul. So every synagogue has some people that you know, that are more difficult to deal with than other people, and who don't appreciate that the rabbi is the fountain of wisdom and really knows the answer to everything, and that they really have no role to play in the synagogue, and they're just there as the audience, right? So they don't get that. So I would discuss it with him once in a while. I would say, you know, I have the problem with this and this and this and that. So he would tell me, he would never answer, but he would tell me stories from his years in Toronto, in Canada, where evidently he really had a group, you know, and who really gave him a run for his money. And he would discuss it with me, and he would just tell me these stories about these people. And then he would say, is this the kind of person? I would say, no, Rebbe, I don't have that. Oh, so what's your problem? He said, you know, like, you know, that's major league balabatim, and you don't have that. So then, you know, then why should you even bother be perturbed about it, etc. He said, "Look, fine, a mention. What do you want?" But he would—he really told me stories that were absolute horror stories. But if you knew 1930s, 1940s European balabatim who came to the United States or Canada and who made a lot of money, so then you knew those stories were true, because the Rabbonim had a very, very difficult time. Very difficult time. It's only later that the communities developed that the Rabbonim were able to have a greater influence and a greater sway. He told me that when you reach a certain birthday, he said, when you have important birthdays, you should take on a new mitzvah, a new thing. So when I knew him, he said to me, he told me a month, he once said, when I'll be 90, I'm going to put on Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, which for a Litvak is really a jump. And he did. So he told me, he said, you'll see, he said, when you'll be 70, 80, 90, 100, he said, always take on something new. Always do something new. Take a leap. Because he said, then that's the blessing that God gives you. That you reach that age, so you have to show your appreciation, so to speak, and this is how to do it. Rabbi Yaakov was an expert in Hebrew language. He was an expert in Digduk, an expert in Hebrew. He used to say that people suspected him of being a maskil because of the fact that he knew all of this so well. So he told me when he came to Tor Vadas, so he said the first shir in Tor Vadas was in Bava Basra. So everybody in the yeshiva knows the first word in Bava Basra is Ashutfin, the partners. It's how to divide up property between them. What is the relationship? But the correct Hebrew way to say it, the correct grammatical way to say it is Hashutofin. And Rabbi Yankiv, who was correct in grammar, got up in front of the whole yeshiva and he said, Hashutofin. And the whole place, he told me, just burst into laughter. Because, you know, what's Hashutofin? Everybody knows it's Hashutofin. And he said, from then on, he no longer said the shiurim grammatically correct. But he said, it's a mir vegeton. I had pain over the fact that I had to use the same mispronunciations that the yeshivas used, when I knew that the correct way to say it, he used to tell me, if Rabbeinu HaKodesh, the author of the Mishnah, would come, he would have said Hashutofin. He wouldn't have said Hashutfin. If Rabbi Yaakov has a sefer, Titei Nemes LeYaakov, on Chumash and on other things, and you'll see in it the great, great understanding of text, of language, of Hebrew, and how he emphasized it, and he emphasized it to anyone that spoke to him. I remember, and with this I'll conclude, I had a large library in Muncie when I was the Rav in Muncie. When we made Aliyah, I left over 1,000 Sforim that were taken by my descendants and my students and part of it became part of the yeshiva library, but I left over 1,000 svarim. I had a copy of the Rambam, a photostat of the Mishnah Torah that was printed in 1480. It's the first printed Mishnah Torah. And it differs to a certain extent from certain texts that we have in the regular Mishnah Torah. Rabbi Yanke would always call me up on the phone and he would say, Voshteit in Ayur Rambam. What is the word in your Rambam? I remember he wanted to know whether the Rambam said Lo Seilchu B'chukos Hagoy or Lo Seilchu B'chukos Hagoyim. Which verse did he quote? Because he says the Rambam is so careful in language that it makes a difference. And if you know what the exact text is, then you have an understanding of what the Rambam is. And he wanted to know what the correct text was. I really feel till today his loss, because he was such a special person. And he had room, you know, for an American young man who did not equal the Lithuanian ideal of what a rabbi was, and who was, at that time when he first met me, beardless and didn't wear a black suit, etc. Didn't fit the role, and he had room for me. And he helped guide me, and he helped inspire me. And I'm therefore enormously grateful that I had a chance to be in his company and to know him and to be part of the circle that was Zoche in all of the places that I was to know Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Thank you. We're going to Daven Ma'ariv now. Next week's lecture is on Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg, the founder of the OU. Thank you for coming. Remember it.